Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, oh, the weather outside is frightful. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Volkelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
And we're going to pick up our conversation about climate change and what could we possibly do about it to help mitigate it?
Because in the previous episode, we talked a lot about how global warming is real.
Yep.
And that it could have detrimental effects on
everything.
Stuff.
Yeah.
In the future.
Yeah. And that it's being somewhat powered by the stuff what we do.
Yes.
In other words, people are causing a rapid acceleration of a more rapid acceleration of the warming trend of the Earth, and therefore we could be in some deep water.
Oh.
For realsies, because of sea level rises. So we wanted to talk about what we could possibly do to help address this.
Well, so people are talking, are having this public discussion about whether humans are actually causing climate change. Let's assume this argument just does not get resolved enough to stop us from adding more and more carbon dioxide to the atmosphere.
And or that the way that society works, it's really hard for us to cut our dependency on things that create carbon dioxide emissions.
Yeah, like cars, power.
Yeah.
I like electricity a lot myself, personally.
All those things, yeah, they add to the problem. So what happens if we get way down in that hole? Is there any way for us to get out?
All right, so this is a great question to ask because I have seen in the past people who were either climate change deniers, if you want to use that term, or they didn't deny that climate change was happening, but they denied that there was anything realistic that we would do because they didn't want the impact for it to be, you know, a negative economic impact or a negative impact to the lifestyle. In other words, they didn't want their lives to be compromised by the fact that there's this massive thing going on. So they said, I'm not worried because science will fix it.
Science
technology will fix it.
There's also a little bit of research that's been done into the economics of climate change and global warming, and people have said that in developed countries, at any rate, the innovations needed to deal with the warming weather will create more jobs and more money.
Well, and
in those specific areas.
There's also the economic argument about how developed countries can have the luxury of investing in technologies that would remove a dependence upon carbon emitting technologies, whereas developing countries would not necessarily have that same luxury. And denying an entire huge segment of the world's population access to the same sort of comforts that we enjoy in other parts of the world seems harsh. When you remember that carbon contains a lot, you know, you can get a lot of energy out of carbon. In fact, that's why we depend upon it so much. So to tell an entire huge part of the world, hey guys, I know you're not where we are right now and you would really like to be able to, I don't know, eat and stuff, but stop using this thing that has all this power in it and deal with that. That's
it's
difficult reality, right?
Yeah.
So a lot of people, they think, well, maybe we can turn to some sort of like crazy solutions to reverse engineer the problem.
Right. So, for example, carbon capture.
I've heard of that.
Yeah. So carbon capture and sequestration.
What is that? Is that where you get like a net and you throw it at a bunch of coal?
Oh, different Annette. Sorry.
No.
I thought we were doing a beach blanket bingo thing here for a second. No, it's not where you get a net and you capture carbon and you drag it off kicking and screaming. It really is talking about putting in systems in places where a lot of carbon dioxide gets released into the atmosphere normally. So things like power plants, you know, anything that's like a coal firing power plant would be an example. To capture the CO2 being given off in that system, which could be a different approach depending upon the actual system you're talking about. In some cases, you might get almost pure CO2 being emitted depending upon, again, what it's coming from, in which case capture would be a little easier. If the CO2 is actually in a mixture, then you have to figure out how you're going to deal with all of this. But the idea is that you capture that, you then put it someplace where it's not going to get into the atmosphere. And the two big choices of just capturing it and then putting it somewhere else are either to pump it into the ocean, deep into the ocean, like deep undersea, or underground. And by underground, I mean, you know, hundreds of meters underground. You're trying to pump CO2 into a porous rock formation that hopefully has a non-porous formation above it, which will block the CO2 from filtering back up. And the CO2 will become trapped underground. There's actually room for gigatons of CO2 underground in this way. And in fact, this is a technology that oil companies already use when they're exploring for oil. They'll pump CO2 down in order to try and find oil deposits. So the technology, the basic technology to do this is already there. It's not being used in this application, but the actual tech exists.
But wouldn't putting a whole crap ton, that's the scientific term, of CO2 down into a place that didn't already have it change?
Well, if you're talking about a strata under the earth that's hundreds of meters below, it's going to change things in a way that doesn't really affect us in any way. It's the same sort of thing as if you were to find a natural gas deposit or something. So if we're talking about the ocean, there are some concerns here, obviously. For one thing, in our last podcast, we discussed the fact that CO2 and seawater can combine in a way that ends up lowering the pH of seawater. So pumping a lot of CO2 into the ocean could end up affecting the pH levels of at least the region around wherever it is you're pumping the CO2 into. That has a potential for affecting an entire ecosystem under the water. So obviously that is something that would have to be studied in depth before we were to roll that out on any kind of wide scale basis, because you don't want to end up removing CO2 from the atmosphere, pump it into the ocean, and just create a brand new set of problems. So that's one possibility. I think that the one about essentially shoving it underground is something that could, at least in theory, take some of the burden of CO2 emissions out of the picture. Although, obviously, we don't have a way of doing that for things like personal vehicles. You know, we've been talking about these massive plants and manufacturing facilities. That would be a big benefit, but it's only part of the equation.
Can I ask a question?
Sure, go ahead.
This process sounds energy intensive, especially if what we're trying to do is offset the carbon we're putting into the atmosphere, creating energy.
Pumping part certainly would require its own energy. I mean, capturing is, you could potentially create a mostly passive system to capture CO2, but it wouldn't, you know, I would imagine a powered system would be more efficient. But when you're talking about pumping CO2 under the ground, that's going to require energy. So you have to figure that out. Exactly. You know, are you just going to have a massive petroleum burning generator that's just releasing more CO2 into the atmosphere while you're pumping? Now, granted, you know, you're talking about different scales here too. The amount of CO2 emitted by a power company, coal burning plant, is way higher than
for a pump.
A pump. Exactly. So, you're looking at a scale, you're talking about reducing CO2 emissions. You're certainly not talking about eliminating them. But that's one suggestion of using technology to try and fight this off. But there are a couple of other, ideas, you know, like, what's this geoengineering thing I see on our outline, Joe?
Geoengineering.
There's a lot of exciting stuff in this one.
Oh boy. Some root words. Okay. So if y'all like, the plots the bad guys come up with in James Bond movies.
Oh, do I?
You'll like geoengineering.
I don't look like Blofeld for, you know, just out of
coincidence. Oh, you do look like Blofeld. I never even thought of that.
I don't, yeah.
You look like Donald Pleasance.
Thank you. Yeah. But between aggravating James Bond and being chased by Michael Myers, my book is full.
007.
Go ahead.
So you've got one about reforestry, I believe.
Well, see, that's a tough one, okay? So there are all these ideas about how we could make major changes to the planet Earth that would help offset either the heating effects of global warming or the atmospheric carbon situation that causes it.
Or in a few that I'm going to talk about, the radiation itself that's reaching the Earth.
Yeah. So to one way or another change the planet to help offset the bad effects of this or to keep it from happening in the first place. And these say, well, okay, so we know there's going to be a lot of carbon out there, so just what are we going to do about it? One idea has to do with plants. Okay, so forests and plants, they create energy by photosynthesis. So they take in carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and nutrients from the soil and energy from the sunlight, and they use all that to turn that carbon into plant matter.
Right.
And they create cellulose and
release oxygen.
And
So wait, this sounds great. So it's taking all the carbon out and it's releasing oxygen. Where's the problem?
Some people have said, hey, I know. We'll use this kind of principle, this plant-based principle in the ocean. And this is this idea of ocean fertilization. Have you heard of this?
Pray tell, what is this ocean fertilization that you...
I would like to talk about ocean fertilization by way of anecdote.
I was hoping for parable. All right, go ahead.
Okay, so there is a Guardian article from 2012 that tells the story of an American businessman from California named Russ George. And he had an idea. He said, oh, okay, well, plankton like iron.
Okay.
A lot of iron in the water. They use this as a nutrient. They gobble it up, and the populations bloom. Well, so they are photosynthetic, and that means plankton absorb carbon dioxide like trees do. The idea of ocean fertilization is you put the iron in the water, the plankton gobble it up, they gobble up CO2, they die, and then they take the CO2 to the bottom of the ocean with them when they sink.
Right.
So that's sort of like a natural way of like sequestering the carbon dioxide.
Yeah, getting rid of it, putting it somewhere else.
Yeah, they put it in their bodies, they sink to the bottom, and then they've got it down there. Out of our hair, right? Well, it turns out it's not that simple. So Mr. Russ George, he went off the west coast of Canada and dumped about 100 tons of iron sulfate in the water, according to this article.
That sounds like a lot.
Yeah, and it spawned a plankton bloom as large as 10,000 square kilometers. Now, you may have heard before of blooms in the water being related to actually not-so-wonderful effects.
Oh, well, yeah. Anytime that you're changing an ecosystem like that, if you've got too much of something at the bottom of the food chain, what's that going to do to the rest of it?
Yeah, there are all kinds of questions about whether this... Well, number one, whether it's safe, and number two, whether it even works in the first place. So
right.
Scientists are still not sure whether this iron fertilization process will actually keep the carbon locked and sequestered at the bottom of the ocean, or if it's only a temporary thing. And then also, they've raised all these, concerns about how it affects ecosystems in the water, about how it can produce chemicals in the water that are toxic and, you know,
so in other words, you're doing more harm than good.
Yeah, and in fact, I think some people think that this can actually worsen global warming.
In fact, Nature, the Journal of Science, Nature,
yeah.
Published a paper about how ocean fertilization should be completely abandoned. They published that back in 2009.
Mm.
And in fact, I can quote a little bit from it. It says, "It is already commonly accepted that ocean iron fertilization should not be rushed into as a mitigation strategy. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change regards it as supported by neither appropriate assessment of environmental side effects nor a clear institutional framework for implementation. Similarly, last year, two United Nations conventions passed resolutions restricting large-scale ocean iron fertilization activities, citing concerns about the environmental risks and lack of a scientific basis on which to justify such activities, concerns that have been recognized for some time. A Royal Society report released this month emphasized that the technique has a relatively small capacity to absorb carbon and comes with, quote, probably deleterious ecological consequences, end quote."
Yeah, so here's our first major geoengineering scheme. Thumbs down?
Yeah.
Thumbs down.
I think I gotta go with nature on this one.
Well, I've got a question.
Okay.
So if the Earth is getting hotter, maybe we can't do anything about the carbon. Maybe it's just gonna be there and it's gonna trap this, you know, so radiation comes down, it comes back up, but it doesn't escape the atmosphere. What if we could reduce the amount of radiation coming in the first place?
Right. There are a bunch of ways that scientists, mad or not, are trying to solve that problem. There's the concept of cloud reflectivity or cloud brightening, which says that, and no one's really sure exactly what effect clouds have on climate right now in terms of, I mean, because they're going to reflect some light from the sun, but they also do absorb some of the radiation coming back up from the Earth. So,
Is it a net loss? Do you break even? That's a question about that.
And we're not sure, but there's a concept that if we can create more low reflective clouds, that could be awesome. One idea for this is that we could get these boats out onto the ocean that are shooting seawater and therefore salt high into the air, creating large bright clouds with the help of the salt, because adding particles to the air creates more smaller water droplets, which creates clouds with a greater surface area for reflecting sunlight. We could even put wind-powered boats out there that would drag propellers through the water to generate the electricity to create the spray. So other than creating the boats, this could be a pretty green adventure.
I just imagine all these fish flying up into the atmosphere.
Like that poor frog in that NASA photo.
They'd be collected in a grate of some kind.
More sushi for me.
It's just called a killing floor. There's really a sluice there.
Yeah, it's more of a grate.
However, this could potentially lead to drought in areas downwind because these clouds would be more rain resistant than normal clouds, and so therefore it might be bad for already drought potential areas.
Gotcha. So again, another potential solution that could end up having unintended negative consequences.
Absolutely. And since we're not sure about cloud's role and everything in the first place, it's a pretty big question mark right now.
Sure.
Now, I'd mentioned salt in the air helping create these reflective clouds. That's technically an aerosol, which is just solid particles of matter in the air. And now different aerosols can reflect or absorb sunlight. We talked about this in the previous podcast, I believe. You know, for example, carbon tends to absorb radiation and keep it in Earth's atmosphere, whereas things like sulfates and nitrates will reflect. So there's an idea to inject sulfates into the stratosphere to provide more of that reflection. There's a lot of potential here. According to NASA, models estimate that aerosols have had a cooling effect that has counteracted about half of the warming caused by the buildup of greenhouse gases since the 1880s, which is significant. However, you know, there's, you know, a model from the University of Washington in 2012 said that this will never fully offset climate change. And furthermore, the idea of just tossing stuff up into the air could have serious impacts on your ecology.
Like if you have chemicals combining in ways that you had not anticipated, then you could end up with things like, you know, acid rain, kind of stuff.
Or certainly different rain that perhaps a environment is not used to.
Sure.
There's another one, and this is my favorite, and that is space mirrors.
Ooh. Okay, so
mirrors in space.
So like a compact for the Earth.
Or I'm really picturing this is the most James Bondy of all of these, I think.
Also kind of Mr. Burns-y.
Yes. I think Mr. Burns is really a failed Bond villain. Only he could cross platforms there. Now, scientists have estimated that you'd only have to deflect about 1% of incoming solar radiation to completely offset climate change.
Okay.
Wow. That sounds cool. Right. Except for the part where that would require maybe 600,000 square miles of mirror. Or many mirrors.
Right.
Put together. Which is a bunch and probably expensive. There are two different leading ideas for space mirrors right now. One is to launch one out in between the Earth and the Sun at a gravitationally stable point about 4 times away from Earth as the Earth is to the Moon. If that just made sense, yeah.
Yep.
And the other is to create a network of steerable mirrors in orbit around the equator.
Gotcha. Mm. So it'd be like a swarm of mirrors.
It would be like a ring. Like we would have our own ring around the planet. Yeah, this is a huge, expensive project, and B, especially that ring of mirrors could create some really weird weather effects. Uneven global temperature changes causing droughts in some places, like, for example, the Americas and northern Eurasia, which happens to be where a lot of things get grown. So.
Yeah. So, well, hey, I got a solution for you guys. Nanotechnology. Put a period in it. We are done.
I love how nanotechnology is the solution of everything.
It's a magic wand, isn't it?
Oh, you know, in the future they'll cure chronic elbow pain with nanotechnology.
Hey,
nanorobots in my blood are going to do that.
So
they might.
So nanotechnology is a legitimate field. So even though we're joking right now, it is very much a legitimate field, and there's some amazing science coming out of it. But again, I think some people point to nanotechnology like it's a cure-all. It automatically, somehow, knowing how to make very, very tiny things will solve all of our scientific problems.
It's like people use the idea of quantum in like science fiction or like healing or something.
Or just using the word science.
But you say, so is this for real? Nanotech for
Nanotech for real can give us very helpful ways of dealing with this situation.
But tell us how.
So nanotechnology is a platform. It's not just a platform. It's not just like, nanotechnology is, you know, you wouldn't go into a scientific laboratory and just see a big vat that says nanotechnology and like, I need some of that. No, we're actually talking about making improvements to existing technologies through the discoveries we make in nanotechnology. For example, solar cells. So one of the issues we have with solar cells, you know, these are, of course, the cells that we use in solar panels to collect solar energy and convert it into electricity. One of the problems you have is efficiency. How much of that energy are you actually harnessing and being able to convert into electricity? Usually tends to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 20%. You know, you have laboratory conditions that can get up higher than that, but in general, they're pretty low. So that means you're losing 80% of that energy. And that's one of the arguments against using solar energy in various applications, saying that it would be more expensive than alternatives. There's a higher startup cost. It's not as efficient. Then you have all these other issues you have to worry about. Well, nanotechnology is one of those things that has taught us a lot about nanostructures and the way that light behaves in nanostructures. But designing specific nanostructures, we can actually direct more light down to hit the solar cell, so you lose less of it in reflection. And that way you can make the solar panels more efficient. So by making that more efficient, you make it a more viable alternative to fossil fuels. So that would take some of the demand from fossil fuels off and put it into a renewable energy source.
Now I feel like you're talking in a more feasible kind of...
Right. Well, when you say something like material science, that's a little bit more, on similar terms, if you have better roads, then all cars, whether they're electric or not, are going to be more energy efficient. But creating the infrastructure to create better roads requires a lot of cement. Cement is really energy inefficient to create. So if we could build a better cement.
Exactly. Or you could use nanotechnology again to design lighter but strong materials and build vehicles out of that. That means you need less fuel to move those vehicles around. So again, this is one of those things where nanotechnology can help in sort of an indirect way, but they can make, you know, that discipline can help make other technologies more efficient and put less of a burden on us when it comes to energy.
So this brings it full circle for me, because I think it sounds like, well, maybe we could do something with carbon sequestration, carbon capture and sequestration. That
maybe,
might help,
yeah.
Maybe. Most of these other plans sound kind of mad scientist, not very feasible, maybe making things worse. What's the real way to deal with this? Bottom line, it's you got to go back to the stuff we've already heard about. I mean, that's what seems like it's going to work, reducing
reducing your consumption in general and relying on alternatives to fossil fuels in general as well. So
right.
Those would be the two main things, right? Is reduce your consumption and shift as much of your consumption to renewable forms of energy as you possibly can. Like just your average electronics are consuming power even when you're not using them.
Yeah, unplugging your television can have a huge effect on your power bill and also on your...
Just energy consumption, yeah.
Because stuff you've heard a million times before, turn your lights off when you leave the house, just, you know, walk places when you can or ride a bicycle. Mm-hmm.
We've done full podcasts on a few of these topics, so we'll try to link them up when this publishes, but... You know, I mean, or we talked a few weeks ago about food, you know, vegetarian eating and the effect that, you know, meat has a huge carbon
footprint. Sure.
Footprint, sure.
Well, you know what? There's one thing we didn't talk about, which are the idea of carbon credits and carbon credit economies.
So is this going to work? Well, we should explain what it is first.
Okay, so essentially what's happening here is that Here's the problem from an economic standpoint. At least this is what some people would argue. They would argue that it costs less money to depend upon fossil fuels than it would to shift to an alternative, at least initially. You might be able to argue in the long term that you would have a benefit, but that's a tough sell for any company.
Well, the alternatives are new technology now, so they're more expensive.
They're more expensive, and some would argue unproven. Some would say they're not efficient, so that would cause other changes in production. It would mean possibly passing the costs down to you, so that essentially, ultimately, the consumer ends up footing the bill for whatever the changes are. There
Which
are a lot of arguments
sell.
Against it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is a hard sell. Well, carbon credits, the idea is to make it less of give less incentive to using carbon when you are a giant company, like a manufacturing company. So basically the idea is you put a cap on how much carbon you are allowed to release into the environment in a given year. You have a certain amount, and beyond that you are not allowed to go. So you have to figure out how to work within that cap. If you absolutely have to do business beyond, like if your business requires that you're going to have to emit more carbon than what you are allowed, you can then purchase the right to emit carbon, or you can trade depending upon the way the economy is set up. But the idea is that at auction, you could purchase carbon emission allocations. You could be allowed to emit a certain amount of carbon for a certain amount of money. The government, in turn, would take the revenue generated from these auctions and pour that into research and development for clean energy alternatives, and trying to do some sort of public good with that money, in theory anyway. That's what would happen. So the idea is that economically you would have the incentive to move away from carbon, because if you stayed with it, you'd have to start paying for it. And one way or another, you would either have to ramp down production so that you worked within the parameters that were given to you, or you'd have to pay money so that you work within the ones you were accustomed to. Either way, it's an incentive for you to move off of that and find some alternative. Whether it works or not, that's a good question, because in the United States, it's been struck down every time it's come up. It's one of those things where, it requires legislation with teeth in it. You have to have the authority to say, like, if you're doing business within this country, these are the rules you have to follow. And if you don't do that, if you just make it a suggestion, then obviously very few companies will adopt that if it means that it would affect the bottom line. So, would it work? There's some question about whether or not it would be a huge benefit, but it would at least give an incentive to companies to try and explore alternatives, while theoretically also pouring more money from the government into sustainable clean energy alternatives. A lot of the arguments I've read are that the private industry it's just not enough to allow for these clean energy alternatives to really get a strong foothold, in part because the United States government, along with other governments, subsidizes fossil fuels. So with fossil fuels getting a subsidy, then they already have an advantage, and so you're playing against a stacked deck. So that's the general idea. Now, I think personally that a carbon credit economy set up fairly, you know, the way it was intended to be, and with the added incentive to move into more clean energy, would at least be a good way to transition, particularly for a developed nation. And we discussed earlier, it's a complicated issue, because you can't just demand that the entire world shifts to this when there are large parts of the world that are struggling for basic supplies that all the rest of us just tend to take for granted. It's a very complicated issue, but I think that this sort of thing would really help. I just, unfortunately, I don't think that carbon credit is something we're going to see, at least in the United States, anytime really soon. I just think that it's too hard a sell politically to have it happen. So that's kind of where we get a lot of people saying, you know, we're hoping that technology can help get us out of this because I don't see another way that's going to happen anytime soon. So, fun times. You guys want to add anything happy and silly before I go? Any mole reptilians that we need to talk about?
I think RoboCop could help.
Okay, RoboCop. So
I think Nano RoboCop could help.
Nano RoboCop?
Yeah.
So we have to go to Nano Detroit.
Yeah.
All right. So we'll go to Nano Detroit and go to the Nano Wonder Bread Factory that's been turned into a Nano Casino, and we'll get help there.
No. I think that all of this is. I mean, we've talked about some things that are not going to work probably ever, but the fact that people are thinking about it and putting research into it is absolutely valuable, even if only to prove that, yes, you should turn the lights off in your room when you leave it.
All right. So, guys, if you have any comments you would like to share or you just want to join the conversation, go to fwthinking.com. That's the website where we've got all the blog posts, podcasts, videos, articles. You can join the conversation there, or you can let us know what you think on social media. You can find us at Twitter and Facebook and Google+. Just search for FW Thinking. You'll find us there. We want to hear from you, and we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.